Hello and welcome to WTM Insights, the official podcast of the World Travel Market London, the leading event for travel professionals. I'm your host, travel journalist Lisa Francesca Nand, bringing you the latest global trends, expert speakers and analysis within the travel and tourism industry. And here are your travel news headlines. After 36 years of providing short breaks, the Super Break travel company has ceased trading. The holiday plans for tens of thousands of British holidaymakers are now in disarray. Super Break was created in 1983, packaging travel and accommodation firstly in the UK and then abroad in Europe. But it's been a difficult time for trading, and together with its sister company, Late Rooms, part of the Malvern Group, it's now gone to administration. Around 200 staff have lost their jobs, and an estimated 400 Super Break customers are still on holiday in the UK or overseas. If you're already on holiday, the costs of domestic holidays will be covered by ABTA. And if you're due to go abroad with Super Break, then the Civil Aviation Authority, the CAA, will cover the costs. Those are the people you've got to contact. There's thought to be about 53,000 customers who have yet to take their Super Break trips, so this is going to affect a lot of people. Now, laterooms.com has also failed their sister company, someone I've used quite a lot myself. No one should lose any money. The business model of this 20-year-old firm, it's a sister company to Super Break, is to connect travellers directly with the hotel and for payments to be made directly. So you shouldn't lose any money for laterooms.com bookings. Cruise alcohol packages have been criticised following the brawl on a P&O ship. Six people were injured and two people arrested after the late-night fight broke out on board P&O Britannia. P&O passengers can buy Ultimate Drinks Package for £39.95, 15 drinks over a 24-hour period. Carnival, that's the people that own P&O Cunard and Holland America, have a similar offer over a 24-hour period starting from 6 a.m. Should stricter regulations be put in place surrounding alcohol service and ships? Well, that remains to be seen. I guess it depends who you are and can you behave responsibly. Industrial strikes threaten to disrupt holiday makers this summer. We've had the strike that was called off at the beginning of August. That was threatening to halt Heathrow. But BA pilots have also threatened industrial action over a pay dispute and a 90% ballot agreement. BA went to the High Court to appeal that the ballot was invalid and their claim was denied. That was on the last day of July. But pilots have to give 2 weeks' notice before striking. And if they do, it could disrupt thousands of flights. And finally, we're getting excited about the launch of Borderless Live. The event will be taking place in East London's Tobacco Docks on the 6th and 7th of September, bringing together content creators, travel experts and brands to connect and learn from each other. With influencer marketing evolving throughout the travel industry, it really is the place to be. We've partnered with Traverse to bring this event to life, and we've managed to get hold of the founder, Michael Ball, and featured Borderless guest, Julie Falconer, to talk about what influencer marketing can contribute to the travel and tourism industry. If this sounds like something you want to be part of, and of course it does, we're giving away two free tickets. All you have to do is take a screenshot of you listening to this episode, then post it on your Instagram story, tagging at Borderless Live, with the hashtag WTM Insights. So listen to the episode, take a picture of it, then post it on your Instagram story, tagging at Borderless Live with the hashtag WTM Insights. We'll include all the info in the show notes, and then we'll choose a winner at random and announce it later this month. Stay tuned. That's the travel news for now. The focus of today's episode is influencer marketing and the impact of social media. So who better than travel blogger Julie Falconer from A Lady in London and co-founder and director of Traverse, Michael Ball. Hailing from San Francisco, Julie studied international relations at Brown University before beginning a career in finance at Goldman Sachs. After moving to London, her travel and lifestyle blog, A Lady in London, became her full-time job in 2010 and has been that way ever since. Her recommendations have been featured in many high-end publications, including Lonely Planet, The Evening Standard, and The New York Times, and her photography has featured in Condé Nast Traveler US and The Financial Times. Michael has had almost a decade of marketing and social media experience, which led him to establish Traverse Events in 2012, followed by Traverse Connect in 2016. Traverse focuses on matching brands to the perfect social influencers and delivering events and marketing to an extremely high standard. And Michael is something of a digital marketing guru. Both will be attending the inaugural Borderless Live event at the Tobacco Docks, East London, on the 6th and 7th of September, bringing together influencers, content creators, and brands from across the globe. And we're very happy to have them here today to talk about the impact of digital marketing on the travel and tourism industry. Hello, both of you, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Does that sound like you? What, in your words, what do Traverse do, Michael?
It seems like a bit of everything. Predominantly work in the travel industry, and we focus on influencer and content marketing and events. So we'll work with brands and destinations to deliver high quality content campaigns, but we also run some larger events and conferences, workshops for both content creators and the industry to come and learn and better their skills.
And Julie, tell me about A Lady in London.
Sure. I started A Lady in London in 2007, right when I moved to London. And originally it was just a hobby because that's all blogs really were back then. But it grew. And by 2010, blogging was becoming something you could monetize. And my blog was, has been established for long enough to have enough of a following. So I turned it into a full-time job at the beginning of 2010. And since then, it's grown and expanded and become much less of a hobby and much more of a consumer-facing publication.
To many people, you're living the dream. So I'm looking to find out more about what you do and your thoughts on things. First of all, I wanted to turn our attention to digital marketing, which is why you're here, and the relevance of this in this technological era. What is it about engaging with people via social media that seems more personal, do you think, than general advertising? And why do you think it's really appealing to people right now? Julie, why don't you go ahead first?
Sure. I think that one of the biggest factors in it is because you are human and it is an individual or a couple of individuals talking about their personal experiences with a brand or a product or a service. And it can come from an authentic personal experience perspective, which advertising obviously doesn't quite have. And I think also people who use social media don't like to feel like they're being marketed to. And I think it comes across from an influencer as a more authentic, genuine kind of experience, as opposed to just sort of an advert that people have to take or leave.
Michael, if I were a brand, how would you sell social media to me? This is something you must do quite frequently, I reckon.
Yeah. Something easy to ask a brand is really, well, actually a more personal question is, when you're looking, let's say, to go to a restaurant, would you trust an advert you read in a newspaper or a recommendation from a friend? So social media influencers and other types of online content creators can kind of get a lot closer to that friend recommendation than your more traditional advertising. And people really listen a lot more and like to book and spend money and generally base their experiences off the back of what they're being recommended.
Now, there are so many social media platforms these days, but the big few, you know, you've got Instagram, you've got Twitter, you've got Facebook, you've got obviously your YouTube videos. What works for you? I'm a big Twitter person. I don't seem to be as big on Instagram. I've got a blue tick on Twitter, and I think that helps me. What is your preferred platform, Julie?
My preferred platform is Instagram, partly because it's so visual and travel lends itself so well to visuals, partly because I got an early start with Instagram. I was on their suggested users list in 2015, which boosted my following quite a bit. And it's just been really good for strategic partnerships. I did a long-term Instagram takeover partnership with BBC Travel for a while. So it's always been kind of growing, and that has helped me reach an audience that's really, really engaged with me there. It's given me tons of traffic to my blog as well, so it really helps with that. And it's just a platform that really clicks.
Why do you think it's so engaging, Instagram?
I think partly it's because it's visual. Like I said before, travel is very visual. People want to see things. They want to feel like they're there. They want to feel like they experience them with you. And with things like Instagram stories getting more and more popular, that's another touch point and another way to show people things in a slightly different, more casual, behind the scenes way.
Are you an Instagram user, Michael? Is that your favorite platform, do you think?
I use Instagram socially, and I love Instagram stories. I guess my favorite platform really depends on what I'm looking for. So if I'm looking at for latest news or following sport than Twitter. Engaging directly with real friends and family is going to be Facebook. And for just kind of having a browse and a flick through, then Instagram. But I still think my favorite kind of longer term platform, if you could say that, would be blogs. Still, I know they're not technically a platform on their own, but from the industry that I work in, you kind of look at them as a platform. And then YouTube's probably the one that I spend the most time on, because I watch loads of different types of video on YouTube.
And what would you suggest for brands that you work with? What do you think is the most engaging for travel brands in particular?
I think it's a good campaign should use multiple platforms. Personally, my view is that you should focus, if you're a traveler, let's say a destination, you should focus your main content on either blogs or YouTube. It's got the long-term benefit, much better long-term engagement. And then use Instagram to support those campaigns. So have someone post a photo to Instagram and use Instagram stories, which then leads them to your blog or their blog or their YouTube channel.
It's also very good to hedge your bets, isn't it? And not to have all your eggs in one basket. There are influencers out there that have all their influence on Instagram. And Instagram has actually been down recently. You know, there have been times when it's been down for almost a day. And I can imagine if you're an Instagram influencer, that has you panicking. Do you think Instagram has longevity, Julie? Are we at the pinnacle at it, or is it going to disappear? Where do you think it's going to go?
I think for now it's here to stay. I think because it's owned by Facebook, they have a very powerful position in the market. But you never know. And there's a huge risk, as you said, to putting all one's eggs in one basket. And so I think from my perspective, it is good to diversify. I do have the blog, A Lady in London. I've got the Instagram, the Twitter, the Facebook, the Pinterest, everything else. So for me, if Instagram went away overnight, yes, it would hurt, but it wouldn't hurt that badly. And I think that's something that everybody should think about, whether they're a blogger or a brand or an influencer in some other way.
Absolutely. There's a figure here that a study from Axon recently suggested that 80% say influencers have a significant influence on their decision on which destination to choose, which is, you know, very interesting for brands and tourism boards. And then now you've got the rise of things like podcasts. They've been around for a long time, but the stats are incredible. 70% of people who listen to an ad in a podcast will act on it. So you've really got to be out there seeing what's next and trying to sort of ride and find that zeitgeist, haven't you?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think a lot of people would say that it's something that you always have to think about what's next as well, and what's coming up and what's going to be the future.
Well, when you work with destinations and brands, how selective do you think you have to be when you're approached by, say, a big band and destination? Are there specific things you look for in a company? Michael, to you, you're obviously not looking to work with brands directly, but you're looking to team up brands and social media influencers. What do you say that people should be looking for, brands in particular?
There's lots of different points that go together kind of to make a good quality or high quality influencer and content creator. One of the first things I think a brand needs to always do is figure out why they want to work with content creators, because as we mentioned before, there's multiple different platforms and there's also loads of different types of influencers even within each of those platforms. Authentic engagement is probably the number one thing that you should be looking for. There's a lot of these fake followers across all platforms, but largely on Instagram, it's very easy to spot, or very much more obvious, I should say. So it's very important to make sure that any of their following and their engagement is authentic and genuine. And then really you want to be looking for the high quality content. And it's not that difficult to spot, to look at YouTube and to look at Instagram and blogs and see where the high quality is. And of course, again, it's very different depending on what your product is. If you're trying to sell a suitcase, which costs £50, then working with someone with a large Instagram following who promote a lot of products could be perfect for you. A few Instagram stories, you get 24 hours on Instagram stories, and then an Instagram post itself is kind of a really good life for 2 or 3 days, then that would be great. People are looking to probably spend £50 based on Instagram photo. If you're looking at selling a cruise, which maybe costs £2,000 plus the rest, then it's probably better to look at maybe a great YouTuber or a good blogger, because they'll write a really in-depth review and really tell you why you want to be going on that cruise. And it's also content that stays there a lot longer, and it's in Google, so you can search it. You know, Google being the biggest search engine, YouTube's the second biggest search engine in the world. So having good quality content, which is SEO'd, SEO there, so people can find it and it will continue to grow for larger products is much better. And then obviously Instagram remains really great. I mean, it does, as I said before, as a support, it's brilliant. I want to see a really nice photo of someone on a cruise ship and then going, oh, I want to know more about this. And they say, link in bio, go through, and I read their blog or I watch their video. So yeah, but again, it's quality.
Do you look at micro influencers? Do you suggest your brands use it micro and not just about the big numbers, but about the smaller accounts as well?
How you define micro depends hugely on which industry you talk to. I know some people that I've talked to about micro influencers, they say under 500 followers. And then some people I speak to say under 100,000 is how they define micro. So it's hugely different. But yeah, absolutely. The engagement level tends to be a lot higher percentage when you've got a smaller following. And again, it depends on your product. If you're selling something which is much more niche, then you don't need a huge following. To go back to the other example, like of suitcases, almost everybody who's an adult needs a suitcase or a bag at some point. But not that many people need or want to book, let's say, a trip to Borneo to see an orangutan sanctuary. You know, you probably want a much bigger influencer to sell your suitcase. But if you've got someone who's got a really engaged blog that focuses on conservation and green and ethical travel with a highly engaged audience, then they're probably going to be better for selling a trip to Borneo to see orangutans.
And Julie, as an influencer, what do you look for when you're going to potentially be working with a brand?
The main things I look for are a fit with my audience. So is my audience actually going to be interested in this? Is this something that I think they will like or want to buy or whatever the sort of call to action is? I also look for, is this a good fit with what I do, with what my brand is, with the kinds of things that I talk about naturally and organically anyway? And then I look at sort of geographically, you know, is this brand something that is trying to reach the audiences that I have in terms of where they are, because sometimes a brand is focused on a part of the world that I might not have a following, or I might have a very small following, but it's probably not enough that this is actually going to work as a partnership. There are also other factors that go into it, depending what platforms the brand wants me to share on. Is it something that I can, you know, photograph easily for Instagram, or is it going to be a bit of an awkward fit with my feed, things like that. And all of that kind of goes into the decision-making process.
So you are reasonably selective then. I imagine when you first start off and people are giving you money to say stuff, you're like, yeah, I'll take anyone. But then later, do you get more selective, or have you been selective from the start?
Well, I've been around for long enough that I remember when no one would ever pay bloggers to do anything anyway. So when you first started out, it was more getting free stuff than it was actually getting paid. But the thought process is the same. Yes, you definitely have to be selective. And just because someone's offering you money does not mean you have to take it or should take it. And you just want to make sure that you are staying on brand and that you're actually balancing the sponsored content with the non-sponsored content enough that people don't think you're just a selling machine and just trying to push product on them.
Well, on that subject, I think it's very interesting what's happened to Instagram recently in the last years and the advertising rules that have come in, because I've been a travel journalist for 15 years and going on press trips is a big part of that. And to a certain extent, as a travel journalist, you're not impartial. You're completely partial. Someone has sent you on a beautiful press trip. They've made it really fabulous and extra special. You know, you come back and write a good feature on it, or do a good video, or, you know, do a good podcast. And recently on Instagram has been the rise of having to put hashtag ad. Now, I've seen this more with, say, influencers that are like, you know, sort of parenting influencers, and then they get given a holiday and people, there will be an absolute uproar if people don't say hashtag ad. Now, hashtag ad doesn't exist in the newspapers. That doesn't exist on online videos. So it's really interesting how Instagram has sort of had to police itself that way, and almost like the people who are engaging with it have been active in policing that. They want to know if you've got a freebie. Do you think that's an interesting development?
Well, I think it's actually all across social. So the ASA has released guidelines, and it's not just Instagram. It's actually YouTube does have to be labeled ad. Blogs have to have this as an advertising feature labeled. Twitter, anything you have that's paid or sponsored or hosted, whatever, has to be labeled. But I do think that that has brought a lot more transparency. I think it's a good thing. I've always labeled things that I got for free as things that I got for free, or things I got paid for as things I got paid for anyway. But I think that bringing more standards in and making it the rule, not the exception, or, you know, something where we have more guidelines to tell us what to do and how to do it, I think it's a good thing for sure.
when it comes to advertising and labelling, one of the issues we've seen over the last couple of years is that the ASA are not being clear at all in what they're putting out there. So it is leading to a lot of confusion to people like yourself thinking that it is only on Instagram. I found it incredibly frustrating trying to work with the ASA. They really don't seem to care. They seem to have seen a crackdown that the BBC picked up talking about people promoting stuff on Instagram, and they have the view that a lot of people of kind of older generations do, which is influencer equals Instagrammer. And it can make it very difficult to do it because some of the rules that they're trying to come up with just simply do not work. They're saying that if you wear, for instance, any kind of stuff that you got given in any photo at any point, you have to label it. Now, that's ridiculous. If I got given this watch 10 years ago, according to Instagram, I would have to put in any of my photos that this was gifted. So I think that while it's really good that we've got a lot of clarity, the ASA need to engage more and they need to stop ignoring influencers when they try and talk to them and ignoring companies like us who have offered to do big free events for them to help promote this because they think they know what they're talking about with it.
Well, I think everyone's very confused, aren't they? It's such a new industry, comparatively new side of the industry, and also it's ever developing, is that it seems like it's always in flux and people are trying to make up rules as they go along all the time, which is confusing for influencers and brands alike. Which brings me on nicely, in a way, to the authenticity of recommendations. There have been some exposés recently regarding influencers and the lack of authenticity in posts. For example, there was an influencer recently who was scrutinised after the pitch board was released publicly for her surprise proposal. I don't know if you remember this case. And the subsequent romantic adventure that went along with that. It was sponsored by a variety of brands. And there was a lot of buzz around fake followers. So how can brands be sure that they're working with someone with genuine reach, Michael?
Well, I mean, it's just research to find out if the influencer themselves and the content creator has genuine reach. There are certain websites and programs you can use to have a look. I still think the best way to do it is to have someone that knows what they're looking for, have a look. There's loads of giveaways. You can use old websites which don't really pick up as much information as they used to, like Social Blade, which used to be fantastic. But again, it seems like Instagram themselves don't really care. So they keep stopping these websites from being able to see this data because Instagram cares about the overall numbers. It's a Facebook-owned company. They want the billions of people. They want to be able to say that. They don't want people and brands stopping using Instagram. So they'll do everything they can to hide the fact that a lot of it isn't authentic. But there are still ways that you can find out what isn't. So have a look at people's, when someone's got 70, 80 comments, have a look at those comments. Are they genuine comments about that photo? Or is it people saying, nice feed, love your stuff, wow, smiley face? Most of those comments, not all of them, most of them are kind of bot comments. So they're automated. Whether it's the person whose account is leaving the comment has set a program to leave certain amounts of comments on certain types of feeds, or if it could be using a company based in somewhere in Asia, usually, where they have people who will go into your account and do this for you. Similarly, they do a thing called follow unfollow, where if you follow a load of people and then a couple of days you unfollow them again, Instagram want more users, so they don't notify you when someone unfollows, only when someone does follow. So a lot of people will then go and see who's followed them and just follow them back. So there's lots of ways to look and try and spot that. But really, it's just a lot of time it's just being sensible. And 100%, or something I would 100% recommend is if you have any questions over a content creator or an influencer you want to work with, ask them. If they've got nothing to hide, they'll have a genuine answer. And I've asked Julie before, a long time ago. I said, I looked at these numbers. What's the reason for the spike there? Because quite often a spike in numbers over a very short time can be because of buying a block of followers. And Julie said, I was when I was doing the BBC stuff. So obviously that, you know, that fits. And most of the time they won't have anything to hide and they'll tell you. And if they go, oh, it just happened, then like there's usually a reason for it. So
I've personally seen accounts that I follow grow 10,000 one week, 10,000 the next week. And you actually, we know that you're buying followers. Do you think that must be quite frustrating for you, Julie, as someone with a lot of genuine followers? Do you find it frustrating? Were you ever tempted? I know that's a very honest question and answer that you'd have to give, but in the early days, were you ever tempted? Or, you know, do you understand what they're doing?
I absolutely find it frustrating. I've never been tempted to buy followers or use bots or any of that. I think it's ruining our industry and it's making us lack authenticity across the board, which hurts everybody. I also realize that people do it. And I think a lot of newer people to this game do it because they look over at, you know, established influencers and they see how far behind they are. And they think, oh, I'll just buy 100,000 followers and get myself into the game real fast. And I can understand that temptation. But I think at the end of the day, it just hurts everyone. And it's going to ruin what we do if we're not careful.
We all kind of jump on the bandwagon. And you like to think that you're not that shallow. But even I, when I'm looking for guests for my podcast, the first thing I will do is look at the amount of followers they have, usually on Twitter, actually, because that sort of more works for me, you know, like we're talking about different platforms working for different people, but Instagram as well. And brands are increasingly doing that, aren't they? Influencers are doing that. We're all, it's almost becoming a little bit Black Mirror, that you're worth your follower number, which is, it's damaging to the ego. So you can see why people, brands and influencers alike, might be tempted to try and boost those figures artificially. But as you said, luckily, there's ways of eking those out and making it a little bit more authentic. So I think it's on that subject, it's very important to stay ahead of the curve, which is difficult when you don't really know what the curve is doing and everyone's sort of scrambling around trying to stay ahead of this curve. But with the social media platforms getting more and more popular, it can be said that the roles of influencer and consumer are almost being blended now. And how do you think you achieve autonomy and interest in your personal brand? Michael, let's go to you first. What would you suggest for your for the people you work with to stay ahead of the curve?
Without this sounding too much like a plug, I would entirely recommend that people go to events and try and keep up to date with the trends through actually physically meeting people. And that's not just events based on the industry you're in. So if you're a parenting influencer or fashion or food or travel, but also more general events, looking at what's happening with Instagram, what's happening with the new platforms, because there are always new platforms, updates from blogging, SEO, YouTube, video in general, photography. So that can always be a really big help. But also there's loads of other blogs and YouTube channels out there which actually look at the industry itself. So the more obvious websites like The Drum and Wired can be really useful. But there's loads of people who actually talk about the kind of behind the scenes of this industry. And it's totally worth just keeping it out there. There's some fantastic podcasts about this. And when it comes to this sort of thing, like podcasts are something I do really highly recommend, because you can listen to them when you're traveling, when you're walking, when you're on a plane. So that can be obviously really useful. But just in general, also, like, don't be scared to try stuff out. There's, so you mentioned, there's loads of new platforms. And in the last couple of years, I've seen a lot of them come and go quite quickly. There was one called Xero a year ago, which was around for about a week, and it was the next massive thing, and then it was gone. But I tried it. I gave it a go, logged onto it. There's TikTok, which is now becoming absolutely huge globally. I think it's the number one in America outside of Facebook and Instagram, so it's overtaken Snapchat.
What is it? I don't know about it.
I would say it's kind of, to me, it seems like the successor to Vine years ago. I know Vine was owned by Twitter. It's different, but it's short video. Predominantly, and it actually came from an app that was called Musical.ly, which then became TikTok. As you've seen with most kind of large social apps, they tend to kind of have pivoted a lot from where they first started, especially the likes of Instagram has done.
I know Musical.ly, it was people singing lyrics to songs, people miming lyrics to songs, and just took off incredibly. But what is TikTok, and how could we use that in the travel industry?
There's a billion people on it, so you can find a way to use those people. It's got a much younger engaged audience than any other programs, including Twitter, including Instagram. And, you know, there's a lot of people who are using it as their primary visual social media platform who are not on other platforms. So there are definite ways that you can work for it. I mean, at the moment, it's mainly physical brands that are using TikTok. And in the UK, it's still very much an emerging platform, but it is becoming very big, and it's definitely one that people should be...
Very interesting, because it might be the time, talking about staying ahead of the curve, it might actually be the time, particularly, like you said, if it's not big in the UK, to start exploring it now, so you can be one of those early adopters. Julie, what do you do to keep ahead of the curve?
Well, like Michael said, I find networking really important. So Traverse's events are really helpful for me. Any kind of meetups. Tonight I'm going to a just happy hour casually organized by some other influencers. And that kind of thing helps because you get a lot of kind of cross-pollination of ideas. You get people talking about the new thing that you hadn't heard about or just something new that maybe everybody's doing that you might want to be doing too. I think also for me, just using social media a lot and following people there and looking at what other people are doing or looking at what you're doing that you suddenly find, actually everyone's really engaging with that thing that I'm doing. That must be something that's, you know, maybe taking off or something I should pursue more.
And if you had one top tip for brands interacting with influencers and social media, what would that be?
There are so many tips. It's hard to choose just one. I would say put the time in. I work with a lot of brands and it's really easy to tell which ones are sending sort of spray and pray emails to 1,000 influencers hoping someone will work with them and which ones have actually sat down and done their homework, which ones are just kind of throwing a bit of budget out to a bunch of people and which ones have really hand selected a number of people that they really truly think are good partners. And it you can always tell the difference in the results, in the process of working with them, in how your audience responds. And I think that's one of the number one things is just you have to put the time in if you're going to be successful.
Michael, what would your top tip be for brands working with influencers and social media?
It wouldn't be a million miles away from what Julie said. Do your research and be personal when you talk to people, whether it's in the way that you email them or in the way that you chat with them. Like, everyone's completely different. And I still think the very best networking you do in this or pretty much in any industry is when you're more relaxed. I always recommend that if people want to meet, let's say a brand wants to meet a specific influencer, it's much better to invite them out for a glass of wine than a coffee. So I think looking at the individual influencers you want to speak to and just doing a tiny bit of research, if you're emailing them, as Julie said, you know, make it clear you haven't just sent the same email to 1,000 people. And it can be something really simple. Something I always do if there's someone I don't know in advance is I'll just quickly check their Instagram stories. And if they're in a certain place or if they've just come back from one, they're like, oh, how's Malta? It looks amazing. It just shows that you've taken that 10 seconds to actually care. And the results you get are much, much better. And then those people will want to work with you and they'll do it cheaper and they'll produce better results.
Finally, it is this year. It's the WTM's 40th birthday, and digital marketing and social influence have been really integral, really, to the growth of the tourism sector. What changes have you seen, and what could you think we can expect to happen in the next few years? Are you worried that digital marketing has already peaked? Michael, I'll start with you.
I hope it hasn't already peaked, but no, I don't. I don't think digital marketing has already peaked at all. I think really it's in terms of travel and social media, it's probably about 10 years old. It's definitely 10 years since I started doing Facebook for a travel brand, which was kind of the first time I was doing that. And I don't think really many companies had started looking at it seriously before that. I don't really know what will be next. That's kind of what's quite exciting about this industry, is that it will be something, it will be different. I should imagine it will just be kind of more movement between which platforms are popular. We've seen quite a lot of the platforms try new things out in the last few years, and with the exception of Instagram stories, nothing's really stuck out of what people have tried. So I think probably it'll be just movement between those. As I mentioned, there'll be new platforms like TikTok coming up, but I think we'll continue to see growth in the existing ones.
And Julie, having been involved as an early adopter of blogging, and you've seen, you know, you've been in really in from the very birth of the industry almost, what do you think is going to happen in the next few years?
I think it's a wide open space. I think, especially in the travel industry, in some parts of it, we're in the infancy of digital marketing. I was at a networking event two nights ago, and it still surprised me how many brands, after all these years, are still saying, oh, well, we've never actually worked with an influencer before, but we'd be open to it. And I think, wow, you know, I've been doing this full time for over 9 years, and I've had a lady in London for 12 years. And it, you know, there are still people who don't quite understand what I do and don't quite understand what digital marketing even is. So I think we're going to see growth. I think we're going to see change. You know, like my Michael said, who knows what's coming next, but it will be something and we're all going to hopefully get on board with it. But I think that's what makes this whole industry exciting and what keeps us kind of keeps us going and keeps us on our toes.
It does indeed. Well, thank you both so much for coming on the podcast.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening to our latest episode of WTM Insights. We'll be releasing exciting content throughout the year, so please subscribe to ensure you don't miss out. See you next time.